Good evening, everyone. We have a substitute altar tonight. It's quite beautiful. John brought. Well, it's getting repaired. Nice.
No introduction.
Well, we could do introductions.
Sure.
Wendy.
Violet. Master.
Stefan. Cool. Kathy.
John.
Kathy.
Ron.
I'm sorry, I didn't know his name.
Oh, thank you, Kaveh. Nice to see you. Well, we have, and you too. It's been a while.
It has been a while, yes.
Yes.
Glad to be back.
Good. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, we're on chapter 12, which he's calling Going Beyond the Beyond. In his inimitable fashion. He says that the Mushotoku ends the first half of the Hanya Shingyo and becomes the subject of the second half. It's about the Bodhisattva by means of the Supreme Wisdom, explains the merits of the Mushotoku mind, the mind of no attachment, of no attainment, of not getting anywhere. There is nowhere to go. He defines Bodhisattva. Bodhi means enlightenment, and Satra means a living person. The Bodhisattva in Mahayana Buddhism chooses not to become thoroughly enlightened and leave this mortal plane for a better place, which is what the original idea was, that you practiced very hard and you crossed over the river and you attained enlightenment and nirvana. And the Bodhisattva vows not to attain nirvana, but to stay in the world. The Bodhisattva doesn't hide out somewhere, as he says. The Bodhisattva stays in the world and takes care of people, takes care of stuff. So it's a different kind of mind. In some Mahayana traditions, that says that bodhisattvas always vow, if there is coming back, to be reborn, always vows to be reborn and do it all over again. So I've always thought that that was a very good way of setting your mind, even if there isn't any coming back. It still gives you a commitment to this place rather than trying to get the hell out of here into some less painful situation. So it's something to think about. Our practice is about bodhisattva practice, and that's what this focuses on at this last part of it. The bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita, depends on ultimate wisdom. And mind is no hindrance. It doesn't say mind goes away. It doesn't say you become unconscious or you get another mind, a better mind. It just says it's not in the way anymore. Mind doesn't block you. It sets you free. It sets you free, and no fears exist. Because our fears are based on the stories our mind is cooking up all the time. And that's when it says, far apart from every perverted view, every blocked view, the bodhisattva already is in nirvana, down on the Alameda somewhere, eating a pizza. And there are lots of examples. Someone just gave me this today, a beautiful little netsuke. Those little carvings, ivory carvings from Japan, that used to be tied onto a noble, usually nobility in Japan, wore these as on their sashes, and it hung a little purse on it, and all kinds of little figures. There are lots of animals, little sheep and pigs and cows and all kinds of people also. And the one I just received is about this big, and it's a little man. And she said, well, that's the one in the ox herding pictures. When the person gets on the ox, he has to find the ox, and then he tames the ox. Do you know this mm-hmm. story? And then begins to be able to ride the ox, and then eventually he and the ox kind of disappear, and then he returns to the world with, it says, bliss bestowing hands. And she said, well, this is that one, this one returning to the world. So that's the bodhisattva, sort of the ultimate thing. So it means ordinary and everyday, and yet practice all the time. He says, only by following the cosmic order can we realize authentic freedom, which means throwing off body and mind entirely without leaving the least room for any sort of self-indulgence. The best means to achieve this is to do zazen, of course, but to do it for the liberation of all humanity. We don't sit for our own sake. We don't sit to get somewhere. We don't sit to be somebody. We sit for the sake of everybody, everything. It means becoming a child when we must help a child, becoming an old person to help an old person. It means becoming a thief to help a thief and a saint to help a saint. This is the vow that the bodhisattva makes real through acting in and with the world. The bodhisattva's satori is wide, noble, and powerful. It gives light to the world. And the world, far from being an obstacle, is the means by which the bodhisattva realizes enlightenment. With no more ego, there is nothing to fear. Possessing nothing, everything can be faced. Obstacles and problems become simple traps set in our way to make us stay vigilant and to continually train our non-ego. This is the wisdom that arises from Mushō Toku, and that the bodhisattva realizes when he's not afraid. And he tells the story of a beggar, a family of beggars. He has funny stories in here. A family of beggars, and they're thieves, and they're stealing all over the town and giving a hard time to everybody. And the little boy in the family under the bridge says to Mom and Dad, "Well, we're really lucky because we are living under here and we don't have anything to take." And I've often thought about that with my own situation. I just love not having anything to take. Nothing spectacular and splendid and expensive. And it's quite a nice feeling. So he goes on to talk about how we create that kind of misunderstanding in our life, the way that we become fearful. He said a young woman went out taking a walk and she saw a snake and she was terrified and she ran away. And the next day she went down the same path and she saw it wasn't a snake at all, it was a rope. This is a very famous story in Zen. Often mistake a rope for a snake. And that's the tricky part of our life, that we jump to conclusions and then we're terrified. It's well to look at least twice to understand what it is without jumping to conclusions. I won't tell you that story. It's ridiculously rude. So the Hanya Shingyo describes four types of tendo, or misperceptions, mistakes, errors, mirages, dreams, fantasies, or hallucinations. The first is the misperception of believing in invariable entities or eternally enduring existence. So this is an error because everything changes all the time. Even the tallest, sturdiest mountain is constantly moving, changing. The second tendo is the fantasy that happiness can be had through worldly satisfactions such as love and friendship, enjoying one's work, travel, and various other activities and amusements. These joys are fleeting and ephemeral. This world can give only a pale reflection of true happiness, which is lived in the dimension of the absolute, beyond the enjoyments of the world of phenomena. A sesshin, he says, enables us to make this journey into a world of another dimension, the world of plenitude. The third tendo is the dream of attachment to the ego. Indulgence of the ego merely leads to errors and suffering. The ego is without noumenon. It's not a thing. It's not real. There's no reason to pamper it, to comfort it, to satisfy it, for this attitude is a circle without escape. Desires escalate, and satisfying them brings only more dissatisfaction. Understanding that attachment makes us suffer is the beginning of wisdom. We must train ourselves to forget the ego so that the great sphere of freedom may be wide open to us. And the fourth tendo is the mirage of believing oneself to be superior to others or of greater value than they. We excel at perceiving the faults of others, but our vision is clouded when it comes to seeing our own. All these attitudes are tendo muso, the four types of misperceptions. But it says perfect wisdom removes all obstacles in the mind of true bodhisattva. There is no more fear or anxiety. Illusions and erroneous views naturally disappear, and the bodhisattva finally attains perfect nirvana. It says the way one thinks during zazen and during everyday life are profoundly different. During zazen, thought arises from emptiness, nothing, the absolute. In everyday life, it arises from shiki, phenomena. Ego is the origination of mumyo, of ignorance. The ego itself is ignorance. The source of all suffering. All things are tendo muso. Illusions are born of desire, which gives rise to sicknesses of body and mind. Past memories and future projects should be the engine of present action. They are as necessary as the air we breathe, but our mental health depends on the dynamic that we give them. Everything changes. Everything passes and is transformed. Life is non-fixation. Every fixed memory, like any obsessive desire, is a cancerous cell in our life. It consumes us, creating obstacles to the circulation of the current of cosmic energy. A calm mind, not tied to anything, lets authentic wisdom appear. Peace is the profound source of joy. To follow the cosmic order is to live a truly happy life, to attain great nirvana. Nirvana extinguishes the flame and is a human being's completion. So he says, depend on intuitive wisdom. It talks about great wisdom. It doesn't mean knowledge. It doesn't mean everything that we've studied so hard and lodged in our mind, but the intuitive wisdom that whispers to us and lets us know what to do, even though our intellect can't figure it out. And a lot of Zen training is to learn to parse the difference between them, to see how we can mislead ourselves with our intellect. And if we drop down deeper into our body, our wisdom becomes more apparent and can help us. Help us every day, all day. So maybe I'll stop there. This is a long chapter. He goes all the way through to the end of the sutra. And then the next chapter is describing precepts and paramitas, which we have studied before, but it will be helpful to study them again. And then we need to think about what else to do. So I will throw that out as well. To to tempt you to think of something else to study in the next little while. Something delicious and helpful. So are there questions? Discussion?
I love the thing that he said about, I've never heard that actually before, but to help a thief become a thief, to.
Yes.
I was thinking what it meant to me, and maybe you can explain what it actually meant, but like that removes the attitude of helping. So you're not separated from the from the person.
Exactly.
From the person that you're
interacting
with. Make them comfortable.
Yes.
You're in their shoes.
Yes. It's the only way you can communicate, really. Otherwise you're from on high, in a high place looking down. And you can't meet anybody that way. So if you meet a little kid, you get down on the ground, face to face. And if you meet a thief, you figure out what's going on with him. See if you can help him.
If we did that in our politics, we'd be better off.
We would be better off, absolutely. Yes.
I am speaking. And the second thing is, I had a question: is that what do you mean by follow? What did he mean by follow the cosmic order? The cosmic order meaning impermanence or things change, or what the dharma, or what do you mean by follow the cosmic order?
I think the cosmic order is dharma and life. It's a way of talking about how dynamic and alive everything is, and how it is in order. In order in the way a forest is or a bush is, not the way that we think of order, where we cut everything up and we have sharp, edges and corners, and everything is according to what's convenient to put together. But things are naturally put together in a completely different way, which is why when we go into the woods, we feel something that we can't quite explain, because it's another kind of order. And if you look at it, you think, oh, it's a jumble. Oh my goodness, look at all those fun things. They don't fit, nothing fits. Let's cut it all back. And there are cultures where they do that. They cut it all up and make it shaped, shaped in animal forms. Or so that's a way to play. But if you're interested in the cosmic order, it's everything that you see that we haven't touched yet, including our own bodies. Yeah, thank you, Kabe.
What do you mean by that last sentence? Including our notes, even in person?
Well, if you think about our body, it's a chaos. Absolute chaos. There are whole villages living in our eyebrows and our eyelashes. We just don't know about it. And our guts have more people than human beings on the earth. It's crawling with creatures, and it's us. So we too are part of the cosmic order, and it's as chaotic as the forest is. We like to think we can control it and fix it, and but we really can't. And it does what it wants to do, and it falls apart. Just like everything else in the forest.
And feeds something else.
And becomes something else, yes. Mm-hmm. yes, which is a very nice thing. And we don't want to take up all the space anyway for too long. So, yeah.
Talking about engaging with the world as the field for the bodhisattva to act, and then he says, you know, don't find happiness in doing your job or loving people or anything that a bodhisattva would. Find joy in peace. So to me, that's a difficult balance to engage. And I guess, well, peace in Zazen, but...
that's a very good question. I think you learn to love people without attachment. I think he's talking about how to be in your life in the world without making it all personal. Because as soon as you get your job and you've got your marriage and you've got your kids, and it all becomes an expression of your own self and your own ego, and you're trying to organize it and make it all work right, it's not a peaceful place to be for you or them. And what he's pointing to is that there's a state of mind that loves everybody and is willing to be a thief with a thief or a baby with a baby without owning them, without the feeling of attachment, of just giving your whole self into the situation completely, 100%.
So all these relationships are transient?
They are. They are all transient. And of course, we have to cry when they break or go. We just do, because we're human. But we also know that's the way it is. You know, the branch breaks when the wind blows. It has to.
It's the cosmic universe teaching us a lesson right outside our window.
Yes, true. Yes, teaching us a lesson every day.
Well, yeah. That's a difficult kind of love to attain, to be completely impartial in how you...
I don't think it...
Embrace people.
Well, when you're with them?
Well, yeah, I'm selective. I live in an apartment house, Angie.
I know.
I mean...
Yeah, with a bunch of cranky old ladies, right?
And some cranky men.
And men, right?
Yeah, and lonely
of course, people, of course.
That would love to talk your ear off.
Yeah.
Corner you.
Yeah. Well, you have to be discerning and disciplined, and help them be disciplined. This isn't saying. People always think bodhisattva means to be a doormat. You know, you just get swamped by things, but it means keeping your own integrity and needing, and figuring out what the boundaries are. But it's necessary to have boundaries.
So how do you set up the boundaries? Do you have friends, or is it just first three people you meet during the day, or
No, you choose your friends, of course. And the people who talk too much, you can just find a way of saying goodbye. You don't have to listen to every single thing they have to say. We never do.
Well, that I understand, but I'm thinking of our concern for people being non-preferential, indiscriminate, and I'm having trouble applying it. How one would apply it if one was a bodhisattva.
Oh, I think bodhisattvas have to choose. I think they're, of course, because each one of us is different. And each one of us has, it's like Avalokiteshvara with all those arms and hands, and each one has a different implement. You know, a surgeon's knife and a whisk and a broom and a, you know, it has all, anything that is needed, the bodhisattva has in her hands. So, depending on what you have in your hand, is what you bring. And if it's not needed, you can depart kindly.
There's a lot of needs out there.
Yes, but you can't fill them all.
I know.
So your job is to find out what you can fill and what you can't, so it doesn't knock you over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, bodhisattvas take care of themselves.
Right. Oh, along with everybody else.
Along with everybody else, but first themselves, because otherwise they can't do anything.
Well, yeah, but you did say that in your book.
Well, he didn't go into detail, that's all.
I see. Okay.
It is 8 o'clock.
Can we go back to the thieves?
Excuse me?
The thieves, I want to go back to those. Are we supposed to help the better thieves, or what is the idea behind this?
Well, if you meet somebody, it doesn't mean our way, our intellectual way, is to name everything. And with the name, we give a meaning and a judgment. And so if you meet somebody who's a thief, you won't know he's a thief in the first place. So the point is to be able to meet people as they are, and then go on from there. And create your own boundaries around it too. It doesn't mean you become a thief so much as you engage with whatever you're encountering in any way that you can help. And it might mean joining the gang for a while if they need your particular expertise. And you can kind of adjust things for them and help them out.
Or I think around here, most of the gangs are called companies.
Oh, Ken. Oh. Well, yes. The big guys, right? Oh my. Yeah. Well, I'll go on next week. And nothing is happening in particular, is it?
Registration for Nahan.
Oh, yeah, for Sashin.
Jikoji. And we have a teacher. It's in Angie's and Coven's lineage. Carolyn Dill, who's definitely a bodhisattva.
She is, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, definitely. She's a wonderful teacher. She knows a lot and knows it on every level. So she's very helpful. So you can slip in and out if you can't stay for the whole time. You can just go for a sit or an afternoon or whatever is convenient. So just let them know if you're going to eat, because they have to provide for the eating.
Yeah, I think it's February 9th, February 7th, 15th.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Because the 15th is Buddha's parinirvana, so it's based on Buddha's death. Parinirvana meaning he finally did achieve final nirvana in his old age.
Okay.
1 minute sit?
Yeah.